As I got older and smarter, my pranks became better, more polished, more sophisticated. Sometimes my stories would acquire a life of their own. I started out tricking my family. When my grandfather found out he was being tricked, he thought it was funny. He encouraged me. My father was mean, and he was dangerous to trick. But it worked with my mother and brother all the time. The vanishing kid trick became a staple. I worked endless variations for many years. The first time was when our mother left Varmint and me together at the petting zoo at Look Park in Northampton. Look Park was a supposedly safe place close to home. She went off to the bathroom and to get us some snacks. She was gone less than 5 minutes. Varmint was 6 and I was 14. I had a sudden flash of inspiration.
Quick, Varmint! Hide in that shed before Mom gets back. We'll trick her.
I pointed to a small building where they stored maintenance tools and supplies. Varmint slipped in and pulled the door shut, but opened it a crack so he could see what would happen. When our mother came back, I was leaning on the rail, reaching out to pet a deer.
John Elder, where is your brother?
Without even looking around, I said,
He went to find you.
She headed back the way she came, looking for Varmint. So far, so good. I glanced over to the shed and grinned at Varmint. Soon she was back.
John Elder, I don't see your brother.
Well, he'll turn up.
Looking unconcerned, I wandered off. My mother followed me. I continued to act indifferent, which got her even more agitated.
John Elder, where is Chris?
He's fine. And anyway, he's just a varmint.
I wish you wouldn't talk about your brother like that.
Now 10 minutes had passed with no sign of the varmint. I was proud of him, staying quiet in the shed all that time. He was doing very well. Our mother was getting really upset, and it was time to spring the trap.
John Elder, I'm getting worried about your brother.
Yes, it was definitely time.
Why are you worried? He's with your friend Paul. He's fine.
My mother did not have a friend Paul. She turned white.
John Elder! What are you talking about?
Varmint went with Paul. They went to find you and ride the train.
We had her now. She was panicked.
I don't know any Paul. Who is he?
How should I know? He's your friend.
That was just the right thing to say. I was getting really good at thinking on my feet.
Oh, my God! Wait here!
She ran off. I decided we might have trouble if she came back with the police and they went looking for Paul. I motioned Varmint out. He was grinning. Even though all he'd done was stand still, he was still proud of his part.
Okay, Varmint, you have to keep a straight face now. Can you do it?
I think so,
he said. Our mother returned with 2 policemen. She saw the varmint. She ran and grabbed him.
Christopher Robeson, where have you been?
The police saw this, lost interest, and wandered away. Before Varmint could say anything, I said, Paul brought him back, just like I told you. Varmint rose to the challenge.
We rode the train and got an ice cream.
He made that up all on his own. I could see it then. One day, he might be as good as me at telling stories. Our mother was suspicious, but she wasn't sure what to say. She didn't want to scare him unnecessarily. She had no idea the whole thing was all a trick, and we were in on it together. She was afraid to say more about this mysterious Paul, since Varmint was, after all, seemingly back in one piece. It was time to distract her.
Varmint, let's go get a paddle boat and ram the other boats and sink them.
She never figured out who Varmint had gone off with, but we were on to something else as we headed for the paddle boats. I didn't stop there. I tricked the neighbors, too, and my teachers. I had a particularly disagreeable high school biology teacher. His ideas of the work I should do and how and when I should do it were far removed from my own. He tormented me during my weekly lab, holding up my sloppily dissected frog for everyone to ridicule. He also singled me out in class, asking questions he knew I couldn't answer. "What's this?" he would ask, pointing to a spitball-sized bit of frog spoiling on my tray. "How should I know?" I thought. But I fumed and said nothing. I could not close my eyes for a moment in his class because he'd pounce. It was exhausting and humiliating.
I pondered how I might respond. I decided he needed reading material to distract him, something to take his mind off harassing nice kids like me. So I went to Bertel's, the local newsstand. I headed for the magazine racks. They had by far the best selection of smut in town. They had magazines like Playboy and Penthouse on an upper shelf in back, but the serious stuff was under the counter, by the cash register. I needed those magazines, but I could not see any way to get my hands on them. I didn't need to take them from the store. After all, I only wanted the subscription forms. But how would I get them? There was only one answer. I would have to buy them. That called for some groundwork, because I didn't have any money. The next day was a Saturday. I went into town with a metal camping plate and a sign. I swiped two milk crates from behind Eddie's, the town grocer. I set up across the street in front of the Quicksilver Bar and Grill. In that location, everyone walking through town would see me and my sign. The sign, which I had made with my mother's art supplies, read, "Children's and Orphans Relief. Help us help them. Your donations count. Save a child." It was remarkably easy. Amherst was a great town for panhandling. In just a few hours, I had $30 in change and $16 bills. My pockets were bulging. Many people just walked by and dropped money into my pan. Often they looked away from me while doing so. Surprisingly, no one questioned or challenged me. I was glad no one I knew walked by. That would have been embarrassing for me. Although for them, it might have been inspirational. If some of my friends had seen my panhandling success, they'd have been out there the next day themselves. By this time in my life, I had gotten to know many of the lowlifes that hung around downtown during the day. Rug, Stump, Fatso, and Freddy, and Willie, the bookie, and Charles, the pimp. I found Rug sitting in a doorway next to a Miller High Life beer sign. "Rug, can you go over to Bertel's and buy me some porn? The good stuff, from under the counter. Buy me 5 good ones, and you can keep one for yourself." He was still hesitant. "Come on, I'll buy you a quart of Schlitz." That did it. I could have saved the cost of a magazine for a 69-cent quart of beer. "Okay," Rugg smirked, thinking I was buying material to satisfy my own base desires. "Fuck you, Rugg," I said. "It's not for me. It's for my teacher." "Hey, you don't have to explain yourself to me," he said. He clearly did not believe the magazines were for my teacher. But he bought them anyway. That evening, I looked up my teacher's address. I filled out the subscription cards in his name, checking the Bill Me boxes. Then I hid one of the leftover magazines in my father's chest of drawers and another in his part of the bookcase, places where my mother would find them and not associate them with me. I slipped one into the parents' waiting area in the school guidance office, and I left the last one in a pew in the church downtown. Before distributing the magazines, I looked through them to verify the quality of my gift. In the back pages of one, I found the ideal product for a lonely high school teacher. "Reversible Ursula, the ultimate inflatable doll, boy or girl, a friend who will never let you down." She was too good to let get away. I went to the post office with 17 of my panhandle dollars and ordered her. Nothing happened for a few weeks. Then, out of the blue, my biology teacher walked up to me one day in the hall. "Say, John, what do you know about Ursula?" "Ursula? I don't know her." I thought not. He sounded sarcastic. I knew then that I had won, and I smiled to myself. He gave me an F in the course, but I didn't care. I got Fs in all my courses by that time. Failing grades didn't scare me anymore. I don't know if he gave me the F because he didn't like my work, or because I stopped going to class, or because he suspected me of sending the lovely Ursula into his life. But I had the last laugh. After school let out, I called Lane Quarry and ordered him 2 loads of crushed stone. "Just drop it in the driveway, please," I said. "Leave the bill in the mailbox. The workmen will take care of it tomorrow." More than 100,000 pounds of rock. And best of all, they were going to expect him to pay for it. Maybe Ursula would help him shovel it out of his driveway.
Chapter 5. I Find a Porsche. When I was 11, my father got tenure and my parents finally bought a house of their own. The one they chose was way out in the woods, in a small town called Shutesbury. I looked up Shutesbury in the Reader's Digest atlas my grandfather had given me. Population, 273. Small towns don't come much smaller than that. Our house seemed very remote. There were 5 houses in a row where we lived, but they were all separated by trees, so none of us could see our neighbors. After the row of houses, our dirt road went on forever with no houses at all, just woods and hills. In fact, all the roads through the woods were named for hills. We lived on Market Hill Road. Nearby, I found Sand Hill Road, Pulpit Hill Road, January Hills Road, and even Flat Hills Road. And shortly after we moved in, they built a new road, High Point Hill Drive. All the houses on our street were brand new, and all the parents living in them taught at the university, except for a few who taught at other schools, like Amherst College or Smith or Mount Holyoke. I soon discovered that some of them had kids my age. We were a little neighborhood in the middle of the woods. It was the spring of 1968 when we moved. My parents moved me from the big Hadley School to a 2-room school in Shutesbury right at the end of the school year. Once again, I made new friends. The couple in the house on our left had 5 kids. Their son Ken was my age, and we quickly became buddies. He had just moved into his house, too, so we spent that summer patrolling the woods around our new homes. After living in cities and then the open fields of Hadley, Shutesbury was a big change. We were only miles from a busy college town, where all sorts of interesting things were always happening. But there were also miles of woods and roads to explore, delineated with signs reading, "Town of Amherst, Watershed, No Trespassing," which every boy in the neighborhood understood as "Private Preserve for Kids." One day, I saw fresh tracks going down one of the abandoned roads into our private preserve. I walked those old roads every day, but I never saw cars driving on them. The roads were narrow, with trees and rocks in the middle and brush hanging over the sides. It had been many years since cars used those roads, many of which didn't even go anywhere anymore. Or if they did go somewhere, the somewhere was now a hole in the ground with a stone post out front where horses were once hitched. Cautiously, I followed the tracks. A few hundred yards in, I reached a clearing. In the clearing sat a new Porsche, a blue one, with tan seats, and a chrome 90 on the back. Someone had left it there, just for me. I knew what it was. I read Hot Rod and Road and Track, and I knew every model of car there was. So I had read about Porsches, but up till now, I had never seen one up close. I approached it slowly. The hood was open. I looked inside, but I didn't see any engine. Had it broken down? Maybe someone had removed the engine to fix it. Then I had another thought. Maybe it was stolen. I remembered what I'd read about car thieves in my Hardy Boys stories. Maybe they were hiding nearby. Suddenly, I was scared. I didn't want to end up tied to a tree with tape over my mouth like the kids in the Hardy Boys stories. I looked all around, but I didn't see anything. There were no sounds but the rustle of the wind and the chirping of birds. Quietly, I closed the hood and crept away. I walked to Ken's house. He was a year older than me. He would know what we should do. Together, we returned to the Porsche. Ken looked at it. Right away, he knew what was going on. "The police parked it here. It's a stakeout. I've seen them on TV. They hide and watch until someone steals it. Then they jump out and arrest them. Maybe they're watching us now. Maybe they've staked out the road." "But it doesn't have an engine," I said. "That's so we can't get away. They must be watching us right now," he answered confidently. I looked around, imagining police in camouflage, hiding under bushes, or maybe in foxholes like the green berets I read about in National Geographic. We ran off.
When we crept back the next day, the car was still there. We circled it, but found no evidence of a stakeout. We entered the clearing.
"I'm getting in," I said to Ken. "Maybe they'll fingerprint it and arrest you at school."
I paused. Could they do that? Then I made up my mind.
"They can't arrest me. I'm just a kid. I'm too young to steal it."
The car was still sitting just as we had left it. I opened the door and climbed inside. I can still remember the feel and the smell of the tan leather seats. I shut the door and looked around. The speedometer went to 120, but I knew it was faster. I had heard any Porsche could pin the speedometer needle. There was a tach, too, to show the speed of the engine, and a clock and some other gauges. There was also a radio with push buttons marked AM and SW. It took a moment to figure that out. Shortwave. American cars didn't have shortwave radios. I was really impressed. My father had a shortwave radio at home, but I had never seen an SW button on a car radio. I imagined listening to the BBC from London, or HCJB from Quito, Ecuador, the voice of the Andes. We listened to them at home some nights. Seeing the SW on the radio reaffirmed how special Porsches were. My mother had just gotten a new car, but it was a Chrysler Newport, a brown one. Why didn't she have a car like this? I started it up, though there was no key. Suddenly, I was driving at Le Mans. I raced through the corners, sliding off the course at one point. I had read how Porsches had the engines in the back, and they spun out on corners. I had to be careful. I sped down the straightaway, over 100 miles an hour, or maybe it was 150. It got dark, and the headlamps cut tunnels through the night. I drove for hours in that Porsche. Then I got out, shut the door, and walked home for dinner. The next day, a truck appeared and took the Porsche away. I guess the stakeout didn't work. They'll probably plant it somewhere else, Ken said as we watched Amherst Towing carry it off. They did all the towing for the police in town. I realized Ken had probably been right all along about the stakeout, but I couldn't figure out how they were watching us. When I got a little older and walked a little farther, I realized people had been stealing cars and dumping them in the woods for years. I'd find them in the strangest places, with trees growing where windows used to be, a 37 Buick Roadmaster, a 56 Chevy Nomad, a 52 Studebaker Champion, and the occasional sports car or truck. My next encounter with a Porsche was 3 years later. I could drive for real by then, and I was more worldly. I had friends with cars of their own, and I helped work on them. Sometimes I even test drove them. It was summer, and I was at my grandparents' house in Georgia. My grandfather called home from the road. He traveled all over the South selling veterinary medicines. He knew everyone in every place in Georgia, Alabama, the Carolinas, and Tennessee. He even knew people in Mississippi and Louisiana.
"John Elder, we have to go to Birmingham. I just bought a car at an estate sale. It's a Porsche."
"What model is it?" I asked.
I knew all the models. The 911, the 912, the new 914, the old 356s. I even knew about rare models like the 904 and the 550. I could identify every single Porsche on the streets of my town. I hoped he had bought a 911S. Maybe he would get tired of it and give it to me. He always drove Cadillacs, and I thought he might be too fat to fit in a Porsche. My grandfather knew exactly what he had bought.
"It's an orange one, John Elder. I gave $2,000 for it. Let's go drive it back."
My grandfather was always buying stuff at auctions. The Porsche was his latest in a long string of diamonds, oriental rugs, fur coats, boat motors, china cabinets, and jade figurines. We headed out together to get the Porsche. In a few hours, we arrived at the car, which was parked in front of a nice-looking house whose contents were being dragged away piece by piece by movers and thugs in pickup trucks. It was a 914, the more powerful model with the 2-liter engine. I opened the hood and proceeded to check it out. It looked like a VW square-back motor. I was familiar with them because my friend Mark had a square-back, and I'd helped rebuild its engine that spring.
"Can I drive it?"
I asked. I had never driven a Porsche before. I didn't have a driver's license yet, but Jack didn't know or didn't care. Licenses weren't as big a deal down south in those days. I got in, and immediately I recognized the smell from that long-ago day in the woods. I started it up, and Jack stuffed himself into the passenger seat.
"Damn, these foreign cars sure are tight," he said.
Jack gave me directions as we headed for the highway. It was very tight, but I liked it. The only small cars I had driven before this were VWs. The Porsche was a lot quicker, and it handled like it was on rails compared to the Volkswagens. I pulled onto the interstate, and without noticing, my speed crept higher and higher.
"You're going to get a mighty expensive ticket, boy."
Jack was looking at the speedometer needle, which sat right near the 100 mark. I hadn't realized I was going so fast. I slowed down till he looked away, but I knew they wouldn't give us a ticket anyway, not in Alabama. My grandfather had a proclamation from the governor, George Wallace, appointing him a colonel in the state militia. And he had a little plate for his own car. It said, "Governor's Staff," and below that, "Stand Up for Alabama." When we got back to Lawrenceville, I carefully washed and waxed the Porsche. I tried to impress my grandparents by taking really good care of that car. I even polished and waxed the farm tractor to earn brownie points. With any luck, the Porsche would soon be my Porsche. My grandfather just had to lose interest in it, and what else could he do but give it to me? But he didn't give it to me. He let my Uncle Bob borrow it, and Bob ran it into a tree. Once again, my Porsche was lost. I would not get another Porsche until I was 25 years old. That was when I saw a beige 912 for sale on a side street a few miles from where I lived. I bought that car and drove it home. I spent countless hours restoring that old Porsche. I rebuilt the engine and then rebuilt the body. I probably removed and repaired every single part of that car, one piece at a time. I stripped the old beige paint and refinished it in a nice aqua green. I got tired of that and repainted it metallic red. It looked flawless. Then one day, I realized that there was a fundamental problem with my Porsche. There was nothing left to fix. So I sold it and found another Porsche to restore, a gray 911E. Since that day, I've owned 17 Porsches, and I've fixed up or restored every single one. Even when I had money, I never bought new cars. Any fool with money can buy a new Porsche, I thought. It takes a craftsman to restore an old one. And that's what I dreamed of being, a craftsman, an artist working in automotive steel. Chapter 6. The Nightmare Years. A dark cloud slid over our family about the time we moved to Shutesbury. There were some bright spots, the woods and my Porsche, for example, but things were spiraling out of control with my parents. Life turned really ugly when we moved into the April House, to use the moronic, jolly name my brother and mother gave our new home. They gave it that name because we moved there in April 1968. My father had been drinking for quite a while, but now he picked up the pace. The empty bottles began accumulating under the kitchen table. They lined the wall, and when we went to the dump, they filled the back of the car. They were not little bottles, either. They were gallon jugs. S.S. Pierce and Gallo were his favorite wines. Sherry, actually. His smell changed, too. He began to reek of liquor. He had always been quick to spank me, but as his drinking increased, he turned meaner and nastier. He became dangerous. Shortly before we moved from Hadley, my father was sitting at the dining table drinking. I walked by him, and I guess I was too noisy, because he grabbed me, shook me violently, then slammed me into the wall so hard that I fractured the plaster. I was stunned, but my mother ran in yelling, "John, leave John Elder alone!" As I sank to the floor, unable to move, he ran outside, got in his car, and sped off. I hope he crashes and dies, I cried.
I didn't like living in Hadley after that. It was a good thing we moved a few months later. The caved-in spot in the wall was an ugly reminder whenever I passed it. As an 11-year-old, I was somewhat able to defend myself. But it's a miracle that 3-year-old Snort grew up to become a varmint and then an adult. He could easily have ended his days with a little squeal in a furnace or an unmarked hole in the ground. I'm sure quite a few unwanted 3-year-olds end up that way. After all, when you live way out in the woods, who's going to notice if a toddler's there one day and gone the next? And my father didn't like Snort too much back in those days. My father would sit each night at the kitchen table, across from the sink and the black and white TV. His hair was tousled, his eyes black and sunken. He slouched back in the chair, with his glass in front of him and a half-empty jug on the floor. His cigarette smoldered in the ashtray, and the pack sat next to it on the table. Sometimes his hand slipped, and cigarette butts scattered all over the table. Sometimes my mother would be there, too, and then their cigarette butts could be anywhere, in the dishes, in the glasses, even in our food. As the night wore on, my mother would wander off. Sometimes she returned to taunt him, which made him all the meaner. I learned to be very careful around him at those times. Sometimes he would call me. "John Elder, come here, son." He would reach out toward me. If I moved toward him, he would try and grab me. That was bad. He'd say, "I love you, son," and he'd scrape his bristly chin against me and make slobbering noises while holding me painfully tight. I was usually able to escape after a few moments when his grip slackened or he reached for another drink. "Come back, son," he would blubber, but I'd run to my room. Sometimes we'd argue, and sometimes he'd whip me with his belt. If my mother was there, she might try to save me from a beating. Maybe he would turn on her instead. I don't remember. Other nights, I'd hide in my room thinking I'd gotten away. And then he'd appear in the door. I buried my face in the pillows, but I could see his shadow blocking the light from the hall, and I could smell him when he came in. Then I could hear him taking off his belt, and I would hope I had a good pile of blankets on me. Whack! The belt would come down. He would hit me as hard as he could. He seemed incredibly strong then, but he was just a drunken, out-of-shape college professor. Otherwise, he might have killed me. I might sob, or I might be quiet. It depended on how hard he hit me. I thought of the knife my grandfather had given me for Christmas. Solingen steel, 8 inches long, sharp. I could roll over and jam it into him right to the hilt, right in the belly. But I was afraid. What if I miss? What if it doesn't kill him? I had seen the movies, where they just kept on coming. They didn't die like they were supposed to. He might kill me for real then. So I never did, but I thought about it many nights. Eventually he would put on his belt, cinch up his pants, and leave. In the daylight, I would go out into the yard and smash my little brother's Tonka trucks with rocks. Big rocks. The biggest I could find. It was all I could do. One night he called my brother instead of me.
"Come here, little Chris," he said, slurring his words.
My brother was too small to mistrust him. Stupid kid. He went closer, and my father grabbed him, set him on his knee. It looked so harmless, just a brainless, smiling toddler sitting on Daddy's lap. He sat there a few minutes, and nothing happened. I relaxed a little. Snort was smiling. Then Daddy reached down and mashed his cigarette out, in the middle of Snort's forehead. My little brother screamed. He struggled. As I write this 40 years later, I can't remember whether he got away. Like dogs that had been kicked, we were wary of him after that. But we would never admit it to anyone else. Getting abused or beaten up or bullied is humiliating, even more so when it happens at home. It took many years for me to gather the strength to tell the stories in this book.
Still, for some inexplicable reason, I did well in school, better than I had ever done or would ever do again. When I graduated from sixth grade, our class had 7 achievement prizes. I won 6 of them. I was used to hearing my father predict that I would end up pumping gas. That night, though, he said, "Son, I'm really proud of what you've done." But then we went home, where he returned to his bottle of sherry alone in the kitchen. And by 9 o'clock, his proud feelings were long gone. None of my teachers knew or guessed that my parents fought every day in those years. Loud, ugly fights. And my father began to fall apart. First, he got psoriasis, nasty white scabs all over his body. I had thought the cigarettes were disgusting, but those scales were worse. They fell off constantly, clogging the drain in the tub. He left a trail of white flecks wherever he went. On the floor. On the rugs. On his clothes. The worst concentrations were in his bathroom and his bed. I kept well clear of those places. My mother had to wash our clothes separately, because if any of mine got mixed up with his, they came out with little white bits of scale on them, and I wouldn't wear them. It would take 3 or 4 washings to get them clean enough to wear again. The way he acted, though, he didn't get much sympathy from me. And then there was the arthritis, and his knees, fluid and pain, and gold shots, and cortisone shots, and who knows what else. He was only 35, and yet he was falling apart. No one knew why then, or so they said. But now I know. He was miserable beyond belief. Both my parents had gone from bad childhoods to a bad marriage, and now I was living with the result. Our father would have been enough for any family, but we had my mother, too. By this time, she had begun the slow slide into madness that would eventually send her to the Northampton State Hospital in restraints. She started seeing things overhead. Demons, people, ghosts. I never knew who or what she saw. They were in the light fixtures, in the corners, or on the ceiling. "Don't you see them?" she would ask. I never did. Some of the things she said were so disturbing, I blocked them from my mind and can't repeat them today. My memories of that time are like blinding flashes of harsh, actinic light. They hurt to recall. My parents drove each other crazy, and they almost drove me crazy. Luckily, the Asperger's isolated me from the worst of the insanity until I was old enough to escape. My mother would say, "John Elder, your father is a very smart, very dangerous man. He's too smart for the doctors. He fools them into thinking he's normal. I'm afraid your father is going to try and kill us. We need to hide. We need to get away from him until the doctor can get him under control." For a long time, I believed her. My brother was littler, and he believed her longer. Now I know. It was all madness, or meanness, on both their parts. By the time I turned 13 and my brother was 5, my mother had found the Dr. Finch that my brother wrote about in Running with Scissors. I remember going to see the doctor for the first time, with my whole family. I was dubious, because my mother had been sending me to therapists, playgroups, and counselors for a while, trying to find out what was wrong. Nothing had worked. But even back then, I could see one thing that was definitely wrong. "We have the wrong parents, Varmint. I've watched my friends' parents. They aren't like ours." Varmint didn't really know. He was too little. My parents often left me to watch the Varmint while they were out. But this time I was going too. So I spoke to him before we left. "Varmint, we're all going out to talk about you with a shrink. I can't stay with you because they want to ask me what to do. Come down here. We'll chain you to the heating oil tank so you'll be safe till we get back." "John Elder, don't you scare Chris like that. We have a babysitter for him." We left Varmint and set out for the doctor's office on the top floor of one of the old buildings that lined the main street of Northampton. We rode an antique elevator, the kind that looks like an open cage, to the 3rd floor, exiting into a large waiting room filled with threadbare furniture, with a girl who turned out to be the doctor's daughter at a schoolteacher's desk against the wall. The doctor's office was behind an old wooden door with his name stenciled on a frosted glass pane, just like the door to the private detective's office in the movies. Inside, the office was very hot and stuffy. The steam heat hissed all the time, and I smelled it in the air. The windows looked like they had never been opened. The office smelled of old carpets and tired people. The doctor came out to meet us. Or maybe we went in to meet him.
"Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Finch," he boomed at us.
He was old and chubby, with white hair and a vaguely foreign accent. Apparently, my mother and father had made a few visits already, and my father had told my grandfather about them.
"Watch out for that Dr. Finch," my grandfather said on the phone,
when I told him we were going to see him.
"I had him investigated."
Why he would investigate the doctor was a mystery to me.
"They ran him out of Kingsport, Tennessee, on a rail, I heard," he said.
I had read about running people out of town on rails in my history books.
"Did they tar and feather him, too?" I asked.
Lots of times, angry mobs did that as part of the running on a rail ceremony, at least according to what I had read.
"I don't know. Just watch him."
So I watched him. Closely. One at a time, my mother, my father, and I went in to talk to the doctor, and then at the end we went in together. I can't remember what we talked about in that first visit, but shortly after we started seeing him, Dr. Finch did two things that changed my life. He told me I could call my parents anything I wanted, and he told my father that he could not smack me around. And unlike the suggestions of every shrink in the past, Dr. Finch's suggestions took hold. My father never hit me again. For this, I will always be grateful to Dr. Finch, despite his bizarre behavior later.
"John has decided on new names for both of you," he said, calling them in after meeting with me alone. "I have encouraged him in this as a sign of his free expression. John?"
He paused and turned to me.
"I have decided to name you Slave," I said, looking at my mother. "And your name is Stupid," I told my father.
"Yes, John Elder," said my mother,
anything to humor me.
"I don't really like that," said my father. "Well, you have to respect John's choices," the doctor said.
Dr. Finch may not have known about Asperger's, but he was the first person to support and encourage my naming of things on my own.
"And whatever he says, you can't hit him."
This was repeated for my father's benefit. My mother never beat me up, and from that day on, my father didn't either. I began accompanying Slave and Stupid to regular sessions with Dr. Finch, and my parents went to more sessions by themselves. Varmint was too small to attend therapy with us at first, and my mother was reluctant to adopt my suggestion that we chain him up in the basement. Mrs. Stotes, the grandmother of one of my classmates, volunteered to babysit the varmint. As we got to know the doctor's family, they kind of adopted us. I began hanging out with his daughter, Hope, and another patient, Neil Bookman. There was no denying that Dr. Finch was eccentric. He lived in a big old Victorian house near the center of town that was always swarming with friends and patients. They all seemed to worship him. I was a little dubious of that, but he'd gotten results from me, so I left it alone. My grandfather never stopped telling me,
"Watch out for that Finch,"
and I heard rumors about him from people in town, but he was the first shrink with whom I'd had a positive experience, and he did right by me in those early years. It was a shame things went so wrong a few years later. Chapter 7. Assembly Required. Until my 13th Christmas, I studied rocks and minerals, dinosaurs, the planets, ships, tanks, bulldozers, and airplanes. That Christmas, I got something new, an electronics kit. My parents gave me a Radio Shack computer kit with 42 components, including 3 transistors, 3 dials, and a meter, in a black plastic case. Easy assembly, batteries not included. The word computer meant something very different in the late 1960s than it does today.
My new computer was really an electronic slide rule, for those who remember slide rules. To use it, you turned the two left dials until their pointers were lined up over the two numbers you wanted to multiply. You then turned the third dial until the meter read zero. When that happened, you looked at the third dial, and it showed the product of the two numbers. Before I could turn the dials, though, I had to build the computer. I had a bag of resistors, transistors, potentiometers, a battery holder, and a meter. "How do I build it?" I asked.
"I don't know, son. What do the directions say?"
"It says easy assembly, whatever that means. We need pliers, wire cutters, a soldering iron, and rosin core solder."
"Well, we have solder here, to solder the plumbing."
Sometimes my father imagined himself a handyman. "The manual says we need rosin core solder. It says acid core plumber solder will ruin it." The nighttime version of my father could turn ugly in the blink of an eye, but the daytime version was actually pretty nice. He almost never said anything nasty about me before dark, and at times like this, he actually worked with me on my projects. How I struggled with that computer. It probably had no more than 20 parts inside, the rest of the 42 components being the terminal strips those parts were mounted on, and the nuts, bolts, dials, scales, meter, and case that everything else lived in. Simple as it was, I arranged and rearranged pieces for 2 weeks before I got it working. My parents bought me books they hoped would help, Basic Electronics and 101 Electronic Projects. My favorite, The Radio Amateur's Handbook, was recommended by the salesman at Radio Shack. By reading those books, I figured it out. On the way, I learned to solder, and I began to understand what the different electronic components were and how they worked. Resistors, capacitors, transistors, and diodes all became real to me, not just words on a page. I was feeling proud of myself, and I was ready for more. I decided to sign up for an electronics class at the high school. Maybe I'll do well in that, I thought. I had gotten straight A's in sixth grade, but my grades had gone steadily downhill once I started junior high, and electronics sounded a lot more interesting than biology or German or gym. Since electronics was a high school class and I was still in junior high, I had to see the teacher and take a quiz of sorts. "What is Ohm's law?" Mr. Gray began. "E over I and R," I answered. "E is volts, I is amps, R is ohms." 20 more easy questions, and I was in. I already knew more than the basic textbooks had to offer. Mr. Gray had an office in a closet filled with vacuum tubes, resistors, capacitors, wire, connectors, and all manner of other parts. I was fascinated. He thought I had already learned enough to skip Electronics 1 and go directly to Electronics 2. But I was so driven that I completed the course material for Electronics 2 in my first few weeks. Then I began nosing around the university and learning what I could on my own. My mother suggested that I go see Professor Edwards, the husband of a friend. Dr. Edwards taught electrical engineering at UMass, and he opened the door for me to a whole new world. He got me into the Labs in Engineering East, the university's engineering building, and introduced me to the brand new Research Computing Center, where they had a Control Data 3800 computer system in a huge air-conditioned room. They adopted me as a pet in the engineering labs. I studied there after school almost every day, continuing with an aggressive home study program at night. I began eyeing the TVs and radios in the house. They were getting old anyway, and I was itching to take them apart so I could figure out how they worked. I decided that my parents should turn over all the household electronics to me right then. "Okay, you can have the old Zenith radio, but not the new one." My parents began handing over the radios. The old TV followed a few weeks later, and I began to amass a considerable inventory of parts on top of the chest of drawers in my room and on the dining table. "Clean these parts off the kitchen table." "Ow! I just got my foot on some old radio part." The complaints became more frequent, and my father decided to take matters into his own hands. Luckily for me, this happened in the afternoon. Later that night, drunk, he would have just thrown my things into the trash. "Son, why don't we build you a work area in the basement?" That sounded good to me. There just happened to be a big door leaning against the basement wall. My father got legs, attached them, and the door became my very own workbench. Soon I was spending all my time in the basement, and I had moved from taking things apart to putting new things together. I began by building simple devices. Some, like my radios, were useful. Others were merely entertaining. For example, I discovered I could solder some stiff wires onto a capacitor and charge it up. For a few minutes till the charge leaked away, I had a crude stun gun. I tried it out on the dog, who ran and hid. That was no fun. So I decided to try it on my little brother. I charged the capacitor to a snappy but non-lethal level from a power supply I'd recently removed from our old Zenith television.
"Hey, let's play Jab a Varmint," I said.
I tried to smile disarmingly, keeping the capacitor behind my back and making sure I didn't ruin the effect by jabbing myself or some other object.
"What's that?"
he asked suspiciously. Before he could escape, I stepped across the room and jabbed him. He jumped. Pretty high, too. Sometimes he would fight back, but this time he ran. The jab was totally unexpected, and he didn't realize I only had the one jab in my capacitor. It would be several years before I had the skill to make a multi-shot varmint jabber. He ran down the hall yelling, "Mama, John Elder did jab a varmint!" I soon moved on to more sophisticated experiments. But I ran into a roadblock. The college engineering textbooks used equations to describe how things worked, but I didn't understand the math. I could visualize the equations in my head, but the ones in my head seemed to have nothing in common with those on the page. It was as though I thought in an entirely different language. When I saw a wave in a book, it was printed next to an equation with symbols I didn't understand. When I saw a wave in my mind, I associated it with a particular sound. If I concentrated hard, I could almost hear the waves. There were no symbols at all. I could not figure out how to relate the two. Yet. Luckily, it was about then that my interests in electronics and music began to converge. I had first become interested in music in the fifth grade. I tried playing the French horn with no success. A few years later, while I was in Georgia, I saw my cousin, Little Bob, taking guitar lessons, and I decided to try playing a bass guitar. My grandmother took me to Wallace Reed Music in Duluth, Georgia, outside Atlanta, where I looked at a guitar with four strings. Down south, they don't say guitar. They say guitar. And they don't say violin. They say fiddle. "That there's a bass, sonny," the salesman said. My grandmother asked the salesman if he could play it. He plugged it into an amplifier, played a few lines, and handed it to me. I had no idea how to play it, but I touched a string and it thrummed in my chest. I was entranced. 30 minutes and a lot of wheedling later, we loaded the bass, a Fender Showman amplifier, a speaker cabinet, some chords, and some music books into the trunk of my grandmother's silver Cadillac and headed home. I practiced all summer, playing along with the radio and studying my sheet music. I was a terrible bass player, though. I could hear the songs in my mind, I could read the music, but I could not translate the music in my head into movements of my fingers over the strings. The sounds that emanated from my bass were clumsy, just as I was clumsy. I eyed my Fender Showman amp. Leo Fender had designed some of the most famous guitars and amplifiers in the world, but I still thought there was room for improvement. Could I take it apart and make it better? Maybe if I couldn't play the bass, I could make something out of the amp. I found a book that might help, Musical Instrument Amplifiers, and whined and pleaded relentlessly until my parents bought it for me. I was full of ideas for integrating my stash of former television pieces into the Showman amplifier my grandmother had bought me. My ideas worked. My Fender amp got louder, a lot louder, and it began to sound hotter. I took it to some local shows and had the musicians play it against their own amps. It ran circles around most of them. "Man, this sound is hot!" Musicians were quick to praise my work. I had a winner. "Hey, can you do that to mine? became a common refrain after someone played my equipment. So I started modifying amplifiers for local musicians, and they told other musicians. I also started fixing broken equipment. I began to understand the relationship between my design changes and how things sounded. Musicians saw that. Can you make the bass snappier? Can you get more definition in the low notes? Can you soften the overdrive sound? With a bit of practice, I became able to turn the words of a musician into technical descriptions that I used in my designs. For example, "This sound is fat," translated to, "There's a lot of even harmonic distortion," and I knew how to add even harmonic distortion on command. Soon the musicians and I moved from changing the sound of the amplifier to creating entirely new sound effects. In those days, reverb and tremolo were the only effects available to most musicians. I began to experiment, producing new effects, new sounds. I also began experimenting with transistorized circuits. The Fender amps were tube technology, designs from the 1950s. Transistor circuitry was newer, and integrated circuits were state-of-the-art. By studying the circuits, I figured out how to make little battery-powered special effect boxes. I worked hard to imagine the results of my designs, and I refined my thought process as I visualized a circuit, then built it for real, and compared my imagined results with the real results. Gradually, I became able to visualize the results of my designs with a fair degree of accuracy. My earlier problems with math texts stopped holding me back as I developed the ability to visualize and even hear the flow of sounds through my circuits. At that point, I had made several key breakthroughs. First, I had gained an understanding of the electronic components themselves. They were the building blocks of everything to follow. Next, I somehow figured out how to visualize the complex calculus functions that describe the behavior of electronic circuits in time. For example, I saw the pure tones of a guitar going into a circuit, and I saw the modified waves, immeasurably more complex, coming out. I understood how changes in the circuit topology or component values would alter the waves. And most remarkably, I developed the ability to translate those waves I saw in my mind into sounds I imagined in my head, and those imagined sounds closely matched what emerged from the circuits when I built them. No one knows why one person has a gift like this and another doesn't, but I've met other Aspergian people with savant-like abilities like mine. In my opinion, part of this ability, which I seem to have been born with, comes from my extraordinary powers of concentration. I have an extremely sharp focus. I spent my free evenings at local concerts and became part of the scene. Club owners, bouncers, and even bartenders began to recognize me. Musicians talked to me, and everyone seemed to respect me. I felt good about myself, and I felt even better when I discovered that many of them were misfits like me. Maybe I had finally found a place I'd fit in. This was a relief, because the situation at home was deteriorating. We had been seeing Dr. Finch for a while now, and my father certainly treated me better, but my parents' fights with each other were still brutal, and both of them were going downhill fast. My father was drinking more than ever, and he was depressed and withdrawn. Sometimes he stayed in bed all day. Often he was simply gone. We didn't have many family activities in those days, and my mother got more and more manic until one day she vanished. "Your mother has had a psychotic break," the doctor told me. My mother returned a few days later, drugged and subdued, but the handwriting was on the wall. In search of distractions, I began hanging around the junior high's audiovisual center. Most of the kids hanging around the AV room were interested in the TV cameras and the school's state-of-the-art black-and-white TV studio. Not me. I wanted to learn how to take things apart, fix them, and make them better. And the two technicians, John Fuller and Fred Smead, taught me how to do it. The two of them really helped me on my way, and I owe them both a debt of gratitude. "Did you ever fix a record player?" John gestured to a pile of Rheem Caliphone record players. The school had dozens of these players. The language departments played lessons on them. The music department played operas on them, Social studies teachers played records of old radio shows. They were fragile, and they were always breaking down. My new work-study job was to fix them. Every item that I fixed in those days taught me something new. I learned how to solder the tiny wires to the phonograph needles, and how turntables and needles work. I learned what went wrong with the circuits and how to fix them. Soon I was banging out 3 and 4 repairs in an afternoon, and before long, the pile of broken record players was gone. "Do you think we can start the kid on tape decks?" Fred said, in the same tone a mother might use to say, "Do you think we can start little Mickey on solid food?" With that, broken tape decks were added to my diet of record players. Within a week, I was fixing all the tape decks for the language lab. These machines had a hard life, going back and forth endlessly as students kept playing phrases and rewinding and playing them again. And it was all a waste. 5 years after getting out of high school, I'll bet 90% of those kids couldn't have made a word of small talk on the streets of Paris or Berlin. But for me, the language lab's tape decks were a ticket to another world. Soon I was using what I had learned by working on them to make flangers and echo delays, a whole new generation of special effects. Local musicians loved them. For the first time in my life, I was able to do something that grown-ups thought was valuable. I may have been rude. I may not have known what to say or do in social situations. But if I could fix 5 tape recorders in an afternoon, I was great. No one except my grandparents had ever called me that before. Another thing I found in the AV room was the girl who became my first wife. Mary Trompke was another shy, damaged kid like me. Something about her fascinated me. She was very smart, but she didn't say much. Still, I was determined to get to know her. We began to talk. She would sit with me as I worked on record players and movie projectors. Soon she started to repair things too, and we would work side by side on headsets and tape decks. I began walking her home every day. She lived in South Amherst, and I lived all the way over the North Amherst line in Shutesbury, so I got in a lot of walking in those years. Her parents were divorced, and she lived with her mother, her 3 brothers, and her sister in a small ranch house. Her father had been a violent drunk like mine. Her mother was overworked, absent-minded, and very dubious of me. I was, after all, long-haired, dirty, loud, vulgar, and male. So she didn't think too much of me when I started walking her baby daughter home after school. But I persisted, because I felt Mary understood me, something I had never felt with anyone before. I named her Little Bear. Her mother called her Mary Lee, Lee being her middle name, or baby daughter. But those names would never do for me. For some reason, I've always had a problem with names. For people that are close to me, for example, I must name them myself. Sometimes I would call her baby daughter to tease her, but she always got mad, and I eventually gave up. Little Bear was what she remained. I thought she was cute, short and solid, with dark hair and pigtails. I was totally smitten. She was the first person I had met who could read as fast as me, maybe even faster. And she read exciting things, books by Asimov, Bradbury, and Heinlein. I immediately began reading them too, but I was far too shy and insecure to ever tell her how I felt about her. So we just talked and read and fixed tape recorders and walked into town every day. That was Aspergian dating, circa 1972. Chapter 8. The Dogs Begin to Fear Me. Any child will tell you that even the kindest and gentlest of dogs will bite if you yank its ears and pull its tail long enough. There is a dark side to Asperger's, and it comes from our childhood dealings with people who do not treat us the way they would like to be treated. As I grew older, it seemed as though there were very few people who made me feel loved. Little Bear was one of them. My father's parents also stuck by me. I used to visit them every summer in Georgia. They lived in Lawrenceville, a small town about an hour outside Atlanta. In my 13th summer, my grandparents picked me up at the airport, the way they always did. My grandmother, Carolyn, was the first person I saw when I walked off the plane. She ran up and grabbed me, and I squirmed away. I was getting a little big to be grabbed.
"Oh, John Elder, look at you. You've grown so big. You are so handsome."
I squirmed some more, but I really liked the way they were always so proud of me and so glad to see me. No one else was.
"Your Uncle Bob is coming up this weekend, and he said he was taking you driving." "Oh, Lordy, my baby boy driving a car."
She led me downstairs to baggage claim and out to where my grandfather Jack's Cadillac was idling in the no-parking zone at the curb. I climbed in and pointed the air conditioner vents at my face as we drove out of the airport. It felt good to be back in Georgia. That weekend, Bob and I got in my grandmother's new car. It was a Buick Electra 225, a burgundy two-door. I was a little nervous, but I moved the power seat forward until I could reach the pedals. I had been driving the farm equipment since I was 12, but now I was about to drive a car, on a road.
"If you can drive a tractor, you can drive the Buick." That was easy for him to say. After all, the car belonged to my grandmother, not him. And as huge as it seemed, it was considerably smaller than my grandfather's Fleetwood. "It's a lot easier to drive than the tractor. It's got an automatic transmission and power steering."
I drove the big tractor on the roads all the time, when I mowed or raked or did other work. It was a red Massey Ferguson. If my grandmother asked, "Can you get me some fertilizer and number 6 shotgun shells at the store, honey child?" I even drove the tractor all the way into town. Sometimes I drove to the Baskin-Robbins to get ice cream. I parked in the parking lot with the cars and went inside. I had to drive as fast as that tractor would go to get home before the ice cream melted. I wasn't scared of tractors because they didn't go very fast. But the car was different. I put it in gear and touched the gas very carefully. The car leaped ahead, and I quickly slammed on the brakes. We skidded to a stop on the white sand driveway. Luckily, there was no one there to see us.
"Gentle, son," my uncle said.
Very carefully, I let off the brake. The car started rolling. Very gently, I pushed the brake. The car stopped. My uncle was right. It was easy to steer, and it had a lot of power. We made it to the end of the driveway without a crash. I stopped where the dirt drive came out of the woods onto Highway 27, right where I would turn the mower around if I was on the tractor. The pavement shimmered in the heat, and every now and then a car went speeding past. I looked across the street to Matthew's Pond, where I caught largemouth bass that my grandmother cleaned and cooked for dinner.
"It's okay. Look both ways and pull out onto the road,"
Bob reassured me from the passenger seat. We pulled out onto the road. I gave the car a little gas, and all of a sudden the speedometer showed 40.
"This car's got the 455 engine and a 4-barrel. It's fast," Bob said.
My grandfather always got the best of everything. I touched the brakes to make sure I could stop, and the tires gave a little chirp. We headed for my great-grandmother's house, a mile or so up the road. My uncle and I called her Mama. She was ancient and small and didn't go anywhere anymore. When I was little, I thought she'd fought in the Civil War, which wasn't true, but she was born only a little while after. She lived in a brick ranch house about 2 miles up the road from my grandparents. She had snowballs made from aluminum foil in her cupboard, and she fed us goulash and fried okra. Mama had never seen me drive the tractor and was very impressed that I could drive.
"Oh, Lordy, John Elder, look at you. You've grown so big, and now you're driving."
Shit, I thought. She's just as excited as my grandmother. They even sound the same.
She just didn't show it as much because she was so old. I was pleased and proud, but I was careful not to let on, because I knew by this time that real men did not show emotions over things like this. She fussed around in the kitchen looking for snacks. My relatives down south always fed me when I came around. My grandmother bought ice cream in 5-gallon buckets just for me.
"You'll be a grown man soon with your own car. Did you know my daddy had the first car in Chickamauga? He had it shipped in from Chattanooga on the train."
I wiggled my ears. All these thousands of cars around me, and my great-great-grandfather had the first one in town. Of course, Chickamauga was a smaller town than Lawrenceville, but even so, woof, I was impressed. I had a real motor car pedigree. Mamma stood in the door to see me drive off. I backed out of the driveway and turned the wheel. I lined the car up, ready to shift into drive. I moved forward, but there was a problem. I got confused. The interactions were too much. The brakes, the gas pedal, the steering wheel, the shift lever. I failed to properly coordinate the sequential operations of the various controls, and the Buick ended up in the ditch on top of the mailbox. In Georgia, there was always a ditch at the edge of the road. My uncle, who had gotten out of the car and was proudly watching me drive all by myself, quickly jumped back to avoid being flattened.
"Damn, John Elder, you wrecked the car. You ran over the mailbox."
"Ooh, John Elder," said Mamma.
My uncle stepped over to the car and put it in park. I got out. My uncle climbed in and backed the Buick into the street. We looked it over. The chrome didn't seem damaged. The mailbox seemed all right, too, just bent a little where it had been yanked out of the ground. I tried to put it back, but the hole was way too big and the mailbox just fell over. It seemed ruined. All of a sudden, I was frantic.
"It's going to be okay," Bob said. "We'll go back and get the post hole digger and fix it."
Bob drove us back home. Out behind the house, he had a shed filled with boxes of nuts and bolts, old tools, lawn mowers, and all sorts of nameless junk. Dandy, my great-grandfather, had filled the shed with all manner of wood-handled agricultural tools. Uncle Bob chose a tool with two long handles coming up from a steel bucket. I was fascinated. I had never noticed the post-hole digger before. It looked like a metal clamshell with long handles. That was a tool that could do a lot more than dig post holes in a farmer's field. I carried it out to the car. My uncle drove. I figured one trip was enough for me for a while.
"I can dig the hole," I said.
I was anxious to try it out.
"I better do it, John Elder. We need to get finished before Mama gets home and finds out what we did to her car."
Bob called my grandmother Mama. I called her Carolyn. Bob rammed the digger down into the ground and picked up a bite of dirt. In a few minutes, he had a hole almost 2 feet deep. We replanted the mailbox and packed the dirt around the pole. When we got back, I took the post-hole digger out of the trunk. I walked over beside the shed and banged it into the ground, just like my Uncle Bob had done. It was hard work. 2 days later, I had dug a hole as deep as the handles were tall. I had dug as far as I could. There were so many things I could do with my new hole. Jump in with a machine gun, and it's a foxhole. Put some paper on top, and it's a pit trap. Drop the dog inside, and it's a dog jail. For the rest of the summer, I dug holes. I wanted to take the post-hole digger home, but my grandparents said they needed it there. When I went back to Massachusetts, I went to the basement to see what my father had for farming tools. He had a post-hole digger, too. I went into the front yard and started going at it. Before the hole was knee-deep, I was stopped by rock. I moved over a few feet, and the same thing happened. Pretty soon, I had filled the front yard with rock-bottomed holes. I hadn't hit rock in Georgia. That was just one more reason it was nicer down there. We had a large pile of wood mulch to the side of the house. My father had gotten a truckload of the stuff to spread around and make the yard look nice. But he never did it, so the mulch was still there, decomposing, where the truck had dumped it. I decided that would be a good place to dig a deeper hole. There should not be any rocks in the wood chip pile. Sure enough, it was easy to dig in wood chips. I hit rock again, but this time the hole was at least 5 feet deep. I was ready to try it out.
"Varmint, come outside. We have a hole to test," I yelled in the window.
He was sitting in his room, wrapped in aluminum foil, looking at the pictures in People magazine. Varmint would often go along with my experiments because he had fun sometimes and didn't usually get damaged. Varmint blinked as he emerged from the house into the light. He always stayed inside in the dark unless I lured him out. I motioned him over to where I was standing, by one of the smaller holes. I had to be careful not to make him suspicious or scare him off.
I want to see how easy it is to get out of these hole traps. Lay down on the ground, and I'll drop you in. You see how fast you can get out.
Okay, he said. I picked him up by his legs and lowered him into one of the little holes. I had to start him on something easy. He swung his legs around and climbed right out.
That was easy.
Of course it was easy. That's why I dropped him in that one first. But I didn't say anything.
Okay, let's try this hole.
We went over to the wood chip hole. I picked him up by the legs again and dropped him in. This hole was deeper than he was tall. He vanished from sight. He kicked and squirmed, and all he succeeded in doing was kicking wood chips from his feet down to bury his head. He was stuck good. I was pleased. This was a fine hole, able to trap a big kid. I went inside for 10 or 15 minutes to get something to eat. When I came out, Varmint was nowhere to be seen. I had expected he would have gotten out in the time I was gone, but he was still in there. I kicked some wood chips in to see if filling the hole would cause him to emerge. He just yelled. I pulled him out before the neighbors heard him. When he emerged, he was quite angry, despite the fact that I'd just rescued him.
"You put me in a hole!" he shouted.
His face was almost purple, and he waved his arms and jumped and yelled. I watched with interest, being sure to stay at a safe distance. He might have been red-faced because he was mad. Then again, he might have been red-faced because he'd been upside down for the previous 15 minutes.
"Of course I put you in a hole, Varmint. That's what you came out here for, to test holes."
He looked puzzled for a minute, pondering the obvious truth of what I just said.
"Real varmints live in holes, and a real varmint wouldn't have gotten stuck like you did. You must be a retarded varmint."
That was too much for him.
"I'm not a retarded varmint!"
And at that, Varmint started banging on me with his little fists. I tried to jam him back in the hole, but he ran off and started throwing sticks and rocks at me. I went in the house and locked the doors. I let him in when he calmed down. The next day, I covered my holes with brown paper bags, which I then covered with dirt. I checked them daily to see if I had caught anything. I encouraged Varmint to try to trap some of his friends in the wood chip hole, but we never succeeded. As summer turned into fall, my holes just sat there. Varmint had taken to driving his toy trucks in and out of the little holes, but he stayed clear of the big one. Halloween was coming, and I had an idea. Back then, explosive flash powder was available for pennies from theatrical supply places. I would fill the holes with flash powder wired to detonators in my room. I would make my own war movie for trick-or-treaters, one in which they would be the stars. I needed more holes. It was time to put Varmint to work. We were ready by the time Halloween rolled around.